Welcome to the Fitness Oracle, where we have real conversations. I am your host, John Katsavos. Today, we have a captivating guest whose journey will inspire you to reach new heights. Our guest today is Chad Hufford, a man whose life embodies the perfect balance of finance, fitness, and faith. Born and raised in breathtaking landscapes of Anchorage, Alaska, Chad's upbringing shaped his deep understanding of the financial industry. But that's not all. He's also a master of athletics, nutrition, and performance psychology. As the owner of Veritas Wealth Management, managing an impressive $500 million for hundreds of families across the United States, Chad brings his coaching mindset and teaching spirit to empower and educate his audience. He believes that true wealth extends beyond financial stability and embraces intentional living and abundant experiences. But Chad's story doesn't end there. Together with his wife, Tiffany, and their six wonderful children, Chad's family thrives in their close-knit Alaskan community. Surrounded by nature's wonders, they relish in fishing, camping, and even the occasional visit from bears, moose, and lynx right in their own backyard. Chad's mission is clear: to serve and enrich the lives of those around him. Through his expertise in finance, fitness, and faith, he aims to uplift others, reminding us that with great gifts comes great responsibility. In this episode, we delve into powerful topics like overcoming defeat and failure, cultivating a healthy relationship with money, and creating better habits for financial wellness and overall well-being. But that's not all. As a part of the Fitness Oracle community, you'll gain exclusive access to our newsletter, be the first to know about our new episodes, enjoy early releases, and embark on a one-on-one phone call with me to discuss your fitness and lifestyle goals. Plus, you'll become part of our vibrant private community, engaging in insightful group calls to share your progress and apply the lessons you've learned. As a member, you'll unlock access to exciting programs and opportunities that will elevate your health and wellness journey to new heights. Are you ready to transform your life? Join the Fitness Oracle newsletter today and embark on a path to a healthier, happier you. Together, let's soar beyond limitations and embrace the extraordinary. Sign up to the Fitness Oracle newsletter today and start your journey towards a healthier, happier you. Now, without further ado, let's get into the show. Chad, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you very much, John. Pleasure to be here.
It's awesome to have you on. So, how's life in Alaska?
You know what? We had finally a sunny day yesterday and spent most of it outside with the kids, enjoying some friends and family. So, very blessed. Can't complain.
That's awesome. You know, I have always wanted to do an adventure from Nome, Alaska, all the way down to the southern tip of South America. And I've never had the balls, if you will, to do it.
No, that would be quite an adventure. I've been to Nome once, and I'll tell you what, John, it was quite an amazing experience. I was walking in between appointments and I turned down this street, and there's an 800-pound muskox. Just, wow. I mean, they almost look, I mean, some of your audience probably doesn't even know what that is. It kind of looks like a bison, but it's a very furry buffalo looking type thing. And literally, I mean, there's 600,000 pounds, and it's just walking down the street. And I told my kids about it, and they're like, do you know how fast a muskox can run? I'm like, I didn't, but I wasn't about to try to find out. So it's a cool place. If you ever get a chance to get out there, of course, that's where the Iditarod ends. There's a lot of historic meaning, a lot of historic impact for Alaska in Nome. But man, it's a beautiful state up here. It gets a little bit cold, but it's a cool place to be and raise a family.
It is. It's one of those. It's one of those places that it just fascinates me. Like I love fascinating and curious places like Alaska, like the northern parts of Siberia. Like the it's this completely off scope of what we want to talk about today. But I've never met anybody from Alaska, so I'm taking every single advantage that I have right now to get as much knowledge from that awesome state.
Oh, absolutely. And it's still the Wild West up here. And you get reminded, our world is so technologically advanced, and it's smartphones and AI and Chat GPT and all these things. But man, if you're caught in a storm out in the wilderness, I mean you're back to basics. Your cell phone doesn't work, you can't get reception. And it's as beautiful as it is, it's still rugged and dangerous, and there's not a lot of places in the country where you can find that. And it's amazing to be able to experience that, and just the awe of it, realizing like I may be the only person, if when you're out hiking or hunting, like I may be the only person for miles, and there's places that are completely untouched. We have less than one person per square mile in the state of Alaska. Like if you take the size of the state and the overall population, it's less than one person per square mile, which is a little different than New York, right?
Oh, a lot different than New York. It's a lot different than Toronto too. I'll be honest with you. We have some places in northern Canada which is like that too. Like it's even less. Like if you
Yes.
go Banff Islands, Baffin Islands, I mean it's like you're the only person on the island. You're
Yep.
fighting polar bears.
Yeah. We've got that too. We'll come
But
visit sometime.
yeah, but it's really cool. I will definitely come and visit Alaska. That is on my bucket list. That is, it really is. But getting back into the groove of the episode that we were recording here, I always ask these two questions before I kick off the show. What got you first interested in helping people with your finances?
So that's kind of is the two-part answer, John. The quick answer would be meeting my wife. And so I'll just give you the real quick background. I have a degree in biochemistry. My goal, my desire was to go into medicine. I thought it'd be fun to be a hotshot surgeon, maybe an endocrinologist. I've been always fascinated with the hormones and all those interactions. But then I met the woman who's now my wife, and I realized very quickly after meeting her, what she wanted was not a hotshot surgeon, but a family. And she wanted kids. She wanted a husband that was going to be around. And I know my own personality, and I realized it'd be very, very difficult for me to balance a career in medicine with being an excellent father and an excellent husband. But I felt like I could be an excellent financial planner and still be an excellent father and husband because I watched my dad do it, and I could have the balance and still pursue the type of life I wanted. So to be honest, it was the initial was a little bit selfish. It was what I thought my family needed, but a lot of that comes from growing up, and here's the second part to that answer. It was seeing people come up to my dad at a basketball game or at the grocery store and thanking him, because he's a financial planner back in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, thanking him for changing the trajectory of their life. Not just helping them with finances, but helping them experience more freedom in their life. I remember as a little kid, like watching that, like that's pretty cool. Like my dad has the opportunity to make an impact in somebody's family and somebody's life. That's pretty neat. But it wasn't until I was an adult that I thought, I think I want to go do that.
Very cool. Have there been any moments where you say, you know what, I'm done with this. I'm just going to go find a job in a bank and just a nice and secure job, and I don't have to worry about finding clients and this and that.
Yes. If I told you that I never looked back, it would be a lie. So I started my financial practice in 2007. I got my first license within 2 weeks of the beginning of the biggest market crash since the Great Depression. It was a very, very difficult time. And I remember a few years later, we were still struggling. It was a very slow process. I mean, essentially, John, I mean, what I was doing in those early years was pretty much jumping out of the bushes at people and saying, "Hey, you don't know me, but how would you like to entrust your family's financial security and all your life savings to me?" And they're like, "Yeah, we're in the middle of a huge recession and you don't have any experience. Your degree's in biochemistry. Like, why would I do that?" So those conversations didn't always go super well. And one day I was at the University of Alaska and I developed some good relationships there. I understood their retirement system very well. And I ran into one of my old professors. And he actually is one of the professors at the University of Washington Medical School. But I was able to get one of his classes in the summer up in Alaska, because he goes back and forth. And I took him for an organic chemistry class. Now, at the time, it seemed really good to take a year of organic chemistry, cram it into a 10-week course in the summer. It was brutal, John. And but he was our professor, so this guy is a professor at a medical school. We're getting him as an undergrad, and it was fast and furious, and he knew it. So we were being thrown into the fire, and because of that, I developed a good relationship. Well, fast forward, I graduate. I'm 3 or 4 years into my career, and I see him at the university, and he stops me, and we exchange pleasantries. And he's like, "Why are you here?" And I said, "Oh, I just had a couple meetings with a couple other professors. I was talking about their long-term financial goals and helping them get the university retirement system in line with what they're trying to create long-term." And he said, No. Why are you here? You should be a physician right now. You have no business doing what you're doing. You should not be here. You should have been in medical school. You should be in residency right now." And it crushed me because this is a man that had a lot of respect for. I knew he had a lot of respect for me. And we were broke at the time. I didn't want to take out loans. I was trying to start this, and we were going dollar to dollar, week to week. Can't even say paycheck to paycheck, because as an entrepreneur, you don't necessarily have a paycheck, right? And it was a very, very dark time for me. It was we had a couple kids at the time, one on the way, and I was doubting myself as a father, as a husband, couldn't provide for my family. And then here's a guy who was a mentor, somebody who I knew believed in me, saying, "You're on the wrong path, man. What are you doing?" And I knew I had medicine as a backup. And that's a heck of a backup, right? And it was, and there was a lot of pride in that too. Like, man, I could be. I instead of this broke kid walking around trying to get somebody to talk to them about money, I could be a physician. People could call me doctor. And it was tough. It was a wrestling match inside my mind for sure, knowing what I felt like I was called to do and what I could do that would make all that pain stop, or at least I thought it would.
How did you get out of that? Because that's a very difficult place to be living in. I know it personally. I know that personally, deep down inside, I really know what that feels like, where your dream is to do something, to be somewhere, to live some way, and you are forced because of life, because of necessity, to be living in the reality of what you have to do.
So I'd like to say that there was a light switch moment and it just all got better, and didn't. It was a slow process. And here, so I love your questions. And here's where some of the answers tie in together. You asked me what helped me get started, or what was the inspiration to get started in this. It was about my family. It was about, again, that maybe not completely selfish, but it was more about me than about the people we were helping. I knew I could help people because I'd seen my dad do it. And we're in the middle of this recession. I saw the fear. I saw other people going through the same thing we're talking about. Like, can I do this? Can I provide for my family? Are we going to lose everything? you know, people saw years and years and years of savings seemingly disappear in a matter of months. So I saw the fear, and I saw people's hopes and dreams starting to disappear. And when I was asked that question by my former professor, I had to really think about, why am I doing this? Because there's easier ways to make money. If it was just about money, I could go do other things. If it was just about my family, I could go and do other things. And what it forced me to do, John, is really dig deep and find some purpose in my pain. And that's what I did. And I was able to really find something much more meaningful than just a job or career. And I think that's when my career turned into a calling, was around that time. And again, it wasn't a light switch. I did not go home happy that day. It was a rough day. But that was part of that transition where it forced me to find even more meaning and fulfillment in what I was doing. And I mentioned this to a class that I teach at church. And just last week, we talk about passion. And a lot of people use that word, I think, way too freely. Because if you look at the base, the very root word of passion means to suffer. It's something worth suffering for. And that's when I became passionate about my career, because I was in the midst of the suffering and I had to make a decision. What is it that I'm doing that's worth suffering for, and finding a purpose in it?
You said suffering for, and bathos is passion in Greek. And yes, it does mean to suffer for something greater than yourself. And it almost seems like you are looking to figure out different ways to overcome failure. It's almost like a scrambling sensation. I'm talking about personal experience from here, because I recently felt this, where I think I had my calling, and I left it for something more secure, and it's devastating, and it does feel like a failure. It does feel like I was defeated. So how do you overcome that? How do you beat that, for the sense of, here's my calling, this is what I was destined to do, and yet out of necessity, here I am, because I need to pay the bills. I need to put food on the table. I need to have a roof over my head. How do you do that? Because that could really drive a man insane if he can't control that.
I think that opens up so many points of discussion. So I think a lot of times it's really easy to choose security over significance, to choose comfort over a calling. Sorry about the alliteration there, but sometimes it doesn't change our destination. Like, we want to go here, and we're here, and we want it to be this nice straight line. And sometimes there's detours around the path. And I think sometimes we're forced to step back into a place of rebuilding before we can continue that pursuit. I tell people, in fact, I was speaking to a local police department the other day, and I told them, and there's an unhealthy view of optimism, that things will always get better. And I told them, there's a world of difference between believing that things will be better in the future and things will always get better. And I'm gonna say that again. So some people believe that things will always get better. That's naive, and it simply isn't life on this planet. But to believe that things will be better in the future, but there's gonna be a lot of trials and setbacks and tribulations along the way, is a much healthier view of optimism. Saying, things will be better here, but man, there's gonna be a lot of valleys. And I think a lot of people want life to look like a staircase. Like, every step is up. And let's face it, John, I think a lot of people want life to be like an escalator. They just stand there and this thing brings them up.
Yeah.
But it's not. It's like climbing a mountain. And you're in Toronto. I don't know what the mountain situation is in Toronto, but here in Alaska, we have a lot. And they're jagged and they're rugged. But there's a lot of peaks. There's a lot of valleys. And sometimes we have to cross valleys before we can keep climbing. And I think the realization that if we are doing the right things, even if we have setbacks, we're headed in the right direction, every step brings us closer to that destination, that destiny, but it doesn't necessarily elevate us, at least in the moment. And I think that's really important as we're going through life, because life happens. It's never as smooth as it looks like on the outside. You know, people see the product. They don't see the pain and the process. So the other thing I was going to mention too, this is going to go back to my experience in biochemistry. We did a ton of experiments, right? And if we look at the traditional view of failure, the uncertainty, the setbacks, there's no difference between most experiments and failure, except with an experiment, you're going into the situation with a willingness to learn from it. And when I was in school, I was doing a lot of research on lipid metabolism. John, I'm a nerd. I'm into fitness, into health, always have been. This is what got me interested in medicine. So we're doing all this lipid metabolism research and studying various animals that had different nuances. And we never knew how the experiment was going to end up. And in fact, the product, the result of the experience, was often not what we had guessed. But we always went into it looking at what can we learn from the process. And I think if people went into difficult situations with that same viewpoint, that they're not married to the outcome, they're not married to the product, they want it to look a certain way, but they're going to learn from the setbacks, they're going to learn from the trials along the way. Does it make failure easy? Absolutely not. Does it make it comfortable? No. But if people can find purpose in that pain and discomfort, again, it's not that we go out to fail on purpose, but it's a willingness to fail with purpose. And those are two very different things.
I love that. I absolutely love that. And you brought up so many good talking points because of it. It's hard. It's very hard and very difficult to be able to look at the failure while you're in it and look for the lesson in there, because it's when you're in it, I'm talking from personal experience. When you lose $100,000 in a year, it's not an easy thing to do. And to look back on it, it's something that a lot of people can't handle. It's not an easy thing, but it's an important thing to do. And I love your analogy of the mountains and the escalator, because I think it's perfect. Everybody, even myself included, I want my life to look like an escalator. To stand on there and bring me up. But I've been knocked down so many times, financially, personally, psychologically, spiritually, knocked to my ass. How do you help people identify the lesson that was learned when you were in the thick of it? Because that's the biggest problem. And how would you help somebody? I know this is about finances, but the finances also tie into how a person feels and thinks and acts. So how would you help somebody just as they feel that they're coming out of it, to look back and say, look, this is what happened. What are the lessons that you picked up from?
I think even just doing that, asking that question, can pull somebody out of that moment a little bit. When life gets tough, when we're hit with setbacks, when we're hit with you know, failure or rejection, all those things are very visceral. And what can happen is the emotional part of our brain, the limbic system, it takes over. And the prefrontal cortex, the area of our brain that processes logic and reason, it kind of gets pushed out of the conversation. And even asking that question, you know, what have you experienced in this moment, in this tragedy, that taught you a lesson? Or what did you learn from this? It allows that reasoning part of the brain to catch up. And it forces people to look at it a different perspective. But I don't think there's a perfect way. I think, and I think for a lot of people too, part of my job in my profession is preparing people for those moments on a financial level. Like, since I've been alive, I don't think there's been any fewer than about 10 episodes where the U.S. stock market has gone down at least 20%. I think this is the sixth or seventh recession since I've been alive. It's that mountain. It's just the valleys are a normal part of the climb, but it's preparing people for that. And I think if we go beyond finances and just look at life, because you said, you know, this is about finance, but I think we both agree this is more about living in freedom. Finance is a tool that I help people leverage, that I help people wield to create financial security and freedom in their life. But if they don't have that freedom up here, I've sat down with multimillionaires, John, who are crying, literally crying in fear of what is going to happen to them, fear of being broke on a park bench, fear of being a burden to their kids. You can have millions and millions of dollars and still live in scarcity. So I've learned that I can't just make it about finance. I have to make it about how people view the world and what is the set tying in the setback today to that future triumph, that future victory. It's like going to the gym. You know, you're in the middle of a leg workout and your legs are screaming at you, your lungs are burning. You want to quit, you want to stop. And you need a coach, you need a trainer, you need a workout partner to remind you, no, this is for your health. This is why you're doing this. This is why you're going through that. And, you know, in that instance, that's a choice, right? You choose to go to the gym. And sometimes some of the things that you and I have both experienced in our personal lives, they were not choices. They were something that were thrust upon us. And we need to be reminded of our own agency. Like, what can I do in this situation right now to improve myself, to improve the situation? And here's the key: to improve the life of somebody else around us and being others focused. Because that's what it took for me. I had to be others focused. I had to look at what is the value and impact on making the lives around us. That's what allowed me to find more purpose and to push through the discomfort. And I think it's easy to feel like our failures, our disappointments, prevent us from being impactful in somebody else's life. And there's a phrase, I don't know who coined it, but Ed Milet talks about it a lot. He says, God does not call the qualified, he qualifies the called, meaning he gives us a mission and a purpose and then shapes us and molds us into the person that we need to be. And a lot of times it's the exact things that we believe disqualify us that make us qualified to help others around us, because we can relate. We can be empathetic. We have a story that they can connect with. Somebody who's never had an issue with an addiction is going to be really hard. It's going to be really hard for that person to help and relate to somebody who's never struggled with addiction. Somebody who's never had a health issue or never struggled with their weight or never struggled with their fitness. It's going to be really hard for them to coach somebody who is a diabetic, who is 80 pounds overweight, who's never felt good about themselves. And it's hard for somebody to get somebody to weather a financial storm who's never been in one. So I think all those things, where we look at the deepest, darkest moments of our lives, sometimes those are the very moments that qualify us, that prepare us to bring others comfort and purpose when they're going through their own storms.
You said something there. Sometimes life just thrusts the storm on you. How can somebody prepare for something that's so unexpected? Like that's just one of those things where it's like snaps you from like left wing and you're like, what happened? So how do you help somebody with that?
Again, I want to answer this in two parts. It's a loaded question. Okay, so.
Yes, it is.
Life is going to be painful. We can try to choose comfort, but discomfort will find us. Yep. So I think it's important to choose discomfort, to find some suffering and do it on our terms. So for me, some of that looks like going to the gym. Some of that looks like some of the educational things, the mental stretches, so to speak, that I do, the things that I don't necessarily look forward to every day, but they're disciplines that I've committed myself to. They force me to be uncomfortable. I'm in the process of writing a book right now. And I mean, I was a kid that could barely write a postcard, you know? So this is, it's, I'll be honest, man, it's scary for me. And I was, somebody asked me last night, like, so, you know, this, is this something you're planning to make a lot of money? I'm not. It's something I want to do to help others. But for part of it, John, is it's something I got to do for myself to overcome some of those fears and the trepidation and choose discomfort on my terms. I think that helps. I think it helps to, Mark Twain said, you have to wake up and eat the frog. And what he meant was, if you start the day by doing something difficult or disgusting, it makes whatever challenges you face the rest of the day a little bit easier. And I think we can take an attitude of life like that, choosing to eat the frog, choosing difficult things that bring us some pain, discomfort, some rejection, or at least the chance of those things. You know, we're flirting with failure. And then when those moments are thrust upon us, we're more resilient. We're better able to handle it. Now, that's something people can do to prepare in advance, but when you're thrust in the middle of it, when you're in the middle of the storm, the time for preparation is over. What do you do then? And I think it's looking for the smallest bit of agency. It's what is the thing that I can do to improve the situation or to at least improve myself in this? And it might be 99% out of your control, but if there's 1% that you can manage, you know, if somebody going through a divorce and their spouse might be horrible and awful, but what is the one thing that they can do to try to repair the situation? And it might not help, it might not fix it, but having agency, acting on something rather than reacting to it is super, super critical. And looking for, you know, maybe it's writing them a note, maybe it's praying for them, maybe it's just a kind word. And is that going to save the marriage? It might not. But what it does is it reminds us that in that moment, we still have something we can do. I still have agency. Can I control the outcome? Absolutely not. And I think a big part of weathering through that is releasing the outcome, which is super hard to do, and focusing on inputs. What are the actions that I can control that have influence in the outcome, but they don't control it? And even somebody trying to lose weight, like the outcome might be, I need to lose 30 pounds, or I need to drop my cholesterol, or something like that. What are the smallest things that I can do to influence that? It might be going for a walk around the block. It might be one Pepsi at lunch instead of two. You know, you're not going to fix it all at once, but what is one small little piece that I can leverage? It might be somebody getting a cancer diagnosis. What is the one thing that they can do? Can they fix the diagnosis? Can they cure themselves overnight? No, they're not going to be able to just fix it. But what is the smallest step they can take in the right direction?
How about mindset and money? I remember I was watching a video of Brian Rose talking to a money guy, and he said that he asked this crowd, what's the first words that pop into your mind when I tell you the word money? And people are coming out with like, we're hatred, despise, abundance, and all this, a lot of negative stuff came out. That negative stuff can affect not just your financials, but also your world around you. How do you help people fix their mindset around money? Because that's a big problem with a lot of people, not just the people that are suffering from depression, but just like you said, multimillionaires are having
Yes.
problems with the mindset around money.
Yes. So I think to a large degree, money makes you more of who you already are. It magnifies the character qualities, good or bad, that you already have. So if somebody's a naturally fearful person and they have money, they're just going to be more afraid of losing the extra money that they have. If somebody is a manipulative person. They will use money to manipulate. If somebody is an angry person, they will act out with money. If somebody's a generous person, they will be more generous with money. If somebody is looking to impact others, when they have money, they'll be able to do more of it. If they're selfish, they will become more selfish. So some of it goes back to like our core wiring. But to your point, money trigger is very much a triggering thing. And it exposes a lot of those things that are already in our hearts or in our minds, the head trash, so to speak. It makes those things come out. And what we try to do is get people to view money as a tool. Now, just like any tool, think of like an axe or a scalpel that a surgeon uses. Used properly, that scalpel can save a life. Used improperly, it could cause even more harm. It could even kill. And money can absolutely be that way. And either we learn to control money or money controls us. And on one end of the scale, it's somebody who's drowning in debt. Their spending habits are out of control. They are being consumed by slavery to creditors, to banks, to their car loans. They're working for things. They're working for, you know, the vacation they took months ago, and it's over, it's done, but they're still paying for it. They're working to pay for their toys they don't even get to use anymore because they're trying to pick up a second job to pay for the snow machine or the four-wheeler or the sports car they just bought. But then on the other end of the spectrum, you could have people that are very, very wealthy, and it makes them paranoid. They're worried about losing it. They're still wealthy, but they're still controlled by money. So it's getting them to a point where they are controlling money. They're telling money what they want their money to do. This is the life I want my money to build, rather than money telling them what to do. Does that make sense?
It does. It does. It makes a lot of sense to getting money to work for you rather than you working for money. And it does make a lot of sense. But I'm still curious to know, would it be possible for somebody to be able to change the way they are? Because I'll use me as an example, because I can only speak about myself. When I get a good paying job, I always want more. Always want more and more and more and more. And the second I start to pay down that Visa or that MasterCard or that credit card, I start buying more stuff. And that is a negative downward spiral that keeps, like you said, it's me buying more toys to fulfill some need that I have no idea what it is. So how can you help somebody break those old habits and create more healthy habits that money can actually, like you just said, get the money to work for you rather than you working for that money?
That's so multifaceted, so many layers. It's a great question. And in many ways, that is the crux of what I do. And the way we do that is different for every person as far as the individual things, but it's finding out whatever bad relationship they have with money, whether it's a fear and scarcity mindset, whether it's just a complete detachment. It's trying to get to the root of that. Sometimes these meetings sound more like counseling sessions than financial planning sessions, as you can imagine, because we're getting into those same things right now. But it's finding purpose for money, finding meaningful fulfillment. And that's what's really hard, is because a lot of times people spend money on things that they think they want, but in reality, it's things that they think other people think they should want, if that makes sense. Like, we're buying the car because we think it might impress the neighborhood. And a lot of this is done subconsciously. We're not consciously doing it. But we're buying things because we think other people value them. Not necessarily because we're trying to impress them or show off. It might be to fit in. It might be to prove our self-worth. I'll tell you what, that even today, God has blessed our business so much. We've been very, very successful. I've been able to help a lot of families. I have an amazing team around me. This is not, this is, I'm just a product of God's grace. But man, John, there's a part of me that would love to show this to my old professor. To be perfectly honest, there is a part of me that still wants him to know that, hey, I made it. You were wrong about me. I wasn't supposed to be a physician. And I've got to be careful that I don't let my own insecurities dictate how I spend and utilize money, because that can become very hard. It can be very harmful. But it's helping people identify like what is meaningful to them. And if they didn't have a job and they didn't have to worry about money because they had all their needs were going to be taken care of, like what would they want their life to look like? And what are the things that they did as a kid? What were the things that filled their cup, so to speak, or that lit their soul on fire? And they're not going to be exact same things as an adult, but there's usually patterns, there's usually themes. And trying to connect money as a tool to its purpose and objective in their life, because it has to be building something. If money is ever the focus in and of itself, it's detrimental. Money needs to be a means to an end. And I'll just give you another example of where this can get in trouble. And this might resonate with some of your audience. Back in COVID, back in 2020, they talked about this thing called revenge spending, right? Mm-hmm. Where you're cooped up in your house and people would just, when they'd open up the world for a few days, a few weeks, people would kind of go nuts, right? But I really think it's different. I think it's reward spending. And I work with a lot of folks in the oil field. I work with a lot of law enforcement too. But oil field is probably our biggest niche. Those guys and gals, they have tough jobs, a lot of stress, a lot of pressure, a lot of uncertainty. The oil field is very, very volatile as an industry. And we've got people saying like, hey, you're asking me to think about what do I want to be 20 years from now? I don't know if I'm going to have a job 20 days from now. Like, I'm project to project. I'm month to month with this company. But there's a lot of other elements too. A lot of folks, they work on the North Slope, like Arctic Circle, polar bears. It's in the winter, it's dark most of the time, 40 below, 50 below. They're away from their families. They're making a lot of sacrifices to do that job. When they come back home, there is a psychological pressure for them to justify everything they went through. They've got to prove to them that job is worth it. And a lot of times that turns into spending. It's they reward themselves for the sacrifices they made. Like, man, I miss my daughter's recital, my son's t-ball game. I miss my wife speaking at, you know, a women's retreat, all these different things, right? I missed life. I'm going to make it up by buying a toy, by taking a vacation that we really can't afford, by doing whatever. We work with a lot of law enforcement, same thing. Like maybe they're on the graveyard shift. They haven't hardly seen their family in weeks. They got shot at last week. You know, like I've got to prove to myself that this job is worth it. Physicians fall into this too. And it's not just keeping up with the Joneses. We can point the fingers and say, well, man, those people just, they need to control their spending. And that's true. But sometimes it's because their money doesn't really have a purpose in their life. And they're trying to reward themselves with money. And what it does is it temporarily numbs whatever the issue is. But people have got to get down and find out what is it that hurts and finding a way around that. And I don't have a perfect answer for you. I wish there's a three-step simple process. But sometimes it's finding stillness. It's finding quietness. Our world is so noisy and busy. And I fall into this too. Like I'm sitting there brushing my teeth, shaving, whatever. I'm like, I should be listening to a podcast or book. I should be learning. In case you haven't noticed, I'm a bit of a nerd. But it's sometimes just listening to the quietness in my soul and feeling some of that pain, feeling some of the frustration. Again, for me, that's in my workouts. A lot of times I don't listen. I have headphones in so people don't talk to me, but I'm just listening to my own thoughts. I'm listening to my own soul. and in dredging the depths of my own insecurities and trying to find out what is actually going on inside of Chad. And that sounds maybe a little fluffy or weird, but I don't think people listen to themselves. I think we fill those silent spaces with something, with our phones, with technology, with conversations, with Netflix, with whatever, with life, with work. And I think some people are afraid to actually hear what they're thinking. And that sounds a little bit weird, but it's necessary. It's necessary for people to step back, find some stillness, and really find out what they want to get out of life.
I don't think it's weird at all. I don't think it's weird at all because whenever I'm, when I used to run, when I go for long walks and my walks are a lot more like marches, I don't have this. I don't have nothing. I can't. I'm too focused on my breathing. I'm too focused on other stuff and focusing on me. That's my me time. So I don't find that weird at all. What I do find interesting is what you said with the revenge spending. And I see that in myself now. And I see myself doing a lot of revenge spending. Here I am, lost 100 grand last year and just got a job, a JOB. I got one of those and it pays very well, pays me very well money. And I, before I had the JOB, I called up my financial planner and I'm like, we need to sit down and we need to talk about how I'm going to take some of this money and invest it properly. And I bought like a whole bunch of supplements and 1 gallon bottle of water that I'm waiting to come on Amazon. I went crazy on Amazon. Most of my paycheck is gone. So I know what that is like. I know what that feels like. Because I went from a state of famine, and now I'm feasting. The problem is I'm going to get bloated. That credit card is not going to get paid down. Those creditors are going to keep calling me. How do you control that?
Okay. So let's actually go back to that metaphor, famine to feasting, right? So one of the things I've been studying for the last 10, 12 years is fasting. And first of all, I'm not a physician. Audience, don't take this as professional medical advice, but there's tremendous research and wonderful benefits associated with intentional fasting, not starvation, but with intentional planned fasting. But I've talked to folks like it just doesn't work for me because I fast and then I just gorge myself and I eat everything. And that's kind of what you were saying. And it can happen financially. And we were talking about the oil field. That absolutely happens. You have guys and gals out there who have a high school degree. Maybe a couple of years of college, but people with a high school degree, not even a high school degree sometimes, they're a welder. They're up on the North Slope making $150,000, $175,000, $180,000 a year. If they go back home to Texas or Alabama or wherever they're from, they might be able to make $40,000, $50,000 a year. And they get used to the feast, and then the famine happens, and it goes back and forth. And it's nasty. It messes with the mind, right? And because our spending habits often grow our consumption, not just in money, but consumption is a better word. Let's not even call it spending. Our consumption often grows to whatever size container we're going to put in. It's like a goldfish. Goldfish keep growing. You put it in a big tank, it just gets bigger. Consumption does the same thing. So we have to artificially constrain that. I think this is where accountability is really important. I mean, that's what makes AA and any addiction type program work is that accountability. People that are shoulder to shoulder in the trenches together saying, I'm struggling with this. John, you're struggling with this. Let's struggle together. Look at CrossFit. Like, that's what makes it work. It's I tease people sometimes because number one, I'm not the guy that wants to be in a group, people cheering. Like, if you cheer for me during my workout, John, I might have to try to fight you. So, like, I just want to be left alone, but I'm not normal. Like, there's probably some screws loose up here. But it's that accountability that people are in there together. They're sweating, they're in pain, they're uncomfortable together. There's camaraderie there. They feel they're in the proverbial foxhole together. And also, if they miss a workout, there's going to be people that miss them. A lot of people are more willing to let themselves down than to let down somebody that they care about. So it ties in that horizontal accountability. It's not just between them and the coach, it's between them and the people around them. So I do think it's important to have a financial coach. I think it's important to have health coaches, but it's also important to have like-minded people around them that are struggling with the exact same things that they are, that can help bring them through when they're lacking discipline. A friend or that coach can be a source of discipline. When they're lacking patience, that friend can be a source of patience. When they're being tempted, that person can step in and say, "Hey, this is what you said you were committed to. Are you still committed to that? This decision does not line up with that. Let's find another choice." We are not meant to do this alone. We are not. We love these like Rambo Lone Ranger stories, but they're just movies. If Rambo was a real movie, then that movie ends like in the first 5 minutes. The best soldiers in the world work in teams, and we are designed to work in teams too. I believe that God made us to rely, to be interdependent on one another. And we live in this age where we become more and more independent. We've used these phones to distance ourselves. And I think we've got to realize that no, we need to work together. This is a marathon. I'm using a lot of metaphors right now, but this is a long journey we're taking together. And there's an old proverb that says, if you want to go fast, go alone. But if you want to go far, go together. And I think in finance, we absolutely have to look at it that way. And you ask some questions, you ask for like some specific things people can do to kind of have a better relationship with meaning and money. So I do have something that I want to get to if we have time, but I just want to make sure that what I just said, does that answer your question? Does that help?
Yeah, it does. It does. Let's get into that offer that you have to help people with this, because I think that might be important as well.
Well, it was so, as I was talking about that one little step, because you asked, how do people find agency? How do you get them unstuck? And so I was thinking, like, what is one thing somebody can do that would work for anybody? Because we all have our money story. We all have the unhealthy relationships with money in various ways. We all do. I do, even though I'm a coach, and I'm aware of what my tendencies might be. But one thing that anybody can do to build a better relationship with resources in general is a gratitude list. Every morning, I've been doing this for years. I read a book, this phenomenal book by Brian Buffini. It's called The Immigrant Edge. And it's if you're feeling down and out and you want something that has meaningful, tangible ideas, but also just makes you feel proud and happy to be alive today in this moment, read that book, Brian Buffini, Immigrant Edge. But he talks about gratitude a lot in that book. So when I read that several years ago, I started doing a gratitude list. I write three things that I'm thankful for every morning. And oftentimes I leave before the kids are up. And I leave it out on our kitchen table so the whole family can see it. Not to pat myself on the back, but so they can see what's in my heart. And I hope that they start thinking about what they're grateful for. So I start every morning with that. Every day we end with, I ask my kids, what was the best part about today? What did you enjoy most about today? And I also ask them, what are you most looking forward to tomorrow? I've been doing this for years. I've asked this question literally thousands of times. But what it does, it gets my kids thinking about what were some great moments about today and to look forward with anticipation to the day ahead. And if people do this and they record these things, and maybe they just type it into a phone or into an app or something like that, or in a notebook or a journal, they're going to start finding themes about what is really meaningful to them. And then they can start attaching money to those things and realizing if helping people, if ministry, if travel, if whatever that thing is that fills your cup, that builds you up, they'll start seeing those themes come out. And it's not going to happen right away. And there's a lot of other things that get better writing a gratitude list, especially early in the morning. Like you start your day looking for what's good about your life instead of complaining about what's bad. not picking up your phone to look at the news, that helps too. Like, oh, like let's check out all the horrible things that have happened while I was sleeping around the globe. Like that's a terrible way to start the day, but starting today, purposefully looking at what is good and wonderful and blessed about your life, you will learn to see during the day when you're stuck in traffic, when you're late to a meeting, you'll learn to see, oh, this is something I can write down about tomorrow. This is something I'm thankful for. You'll learn to see the good in life and not ignore the bad, but to be able to look past it or look through it. And I think that's a really tangible step that people can take to finding out what money can do for them, to leverage that thing. Because what's deeply purposeful and meaningful to me isn't going to be the same thing it is to you, John. We have different things that light our fires, and it is very much an individual journey.
I love that. I love that. Part of my practice is gratitude lists, and not the, I'm grateful for my parents. I'm grateful for my spouses. I'm grateful for my kids or my siblings, something more deeper. And I love that. I love how you start the day with it. And I haven't read that. It's The Immigrant Edge.
Immigrant Edge by Brian Buffini. He's an Irishman that came here at 19 years old with like $72 in his pocket, got in a terrible, terrible car accident. He was on a motorcycle. The other person was in a car. The car won. So he doesn't know anybody. He doesn't understand the culture. He has no job. He has no money. His leg is broken and it gets gangrene.
Oh.
So this is like 30 something years ago. He ends up being several hundred thousand dollars in debt in like, 1990 money or 1985 money, which is, probably $1 million today. No job, no money, no connections, hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt. And it was this mindset that he had to develop. And the book has so many practical takeaways. And really, so the crux of the book is why do immigrants seem to have an advantage when they come to this country? And he gives examples of what those advantages are. And a lot of them are just mindsets. They remember where they came from. They realize they're coming to a better place. They see opportunity instead of obstacles. So there's a phrase, I don't think he uses it, but there's a phrase that says, fish experience water last. They're surrounded it. They don't, it's not new and wonderful to them. Mm-hmm. 'Cause they're always in it. And here in America, there's so much opportunity. And I'm not saying that this country's perfect. I'm not saying that there's not terrible things that still go on. There absolutely is. But we're surrounded by so many opportunities that we ignore those. We focus on the obstacle. Part of this book is helping people see the opportunity in North America that people have, that they've probably been surrounded by, that when people come from another country, it's obvious to them. But we look past it because it's all we've ever known. So yeah, Immigrant Edge by Brian Buffini. It is, I don't finish all the books I start, but I finish usually between 100 and 140 books a year. So over the last few years, probably read close to 1,000 books. This is still one of my favorites. It is one of the most uplifting books that I've ever read. And I just reread it here a few months ago. It's super encouraging, but also very practical.
I have to pick that book up and take a read because I love reading. And I agree with you because I remember this story where we're going to come close to the end of this and close to the end of the show, but I just want to throw this in there. 1996, I was in Greece. I was in Athens, staying at my aunt's house in Athens, and it had a clear view of the Acropolis. Like, you could see the Acropolis in the distance. And I looked at my cousin and I'm like, gee, I wonder how many times have you been up there? And he just looked at me. I was 20. I turned 20. So he was maybe 21, 22. And he just looked at me and he's like, I've been up there maybe two times. I'm like, you have the Acropolis, cradle of modern democracy, the cradle of our modern civilization. And you've only been up there a couple of times in the last 20, 21 years. And he's like, I see it every day, John. I see it every day. I'm like, if I was here, I would be up there at least twice a year.
Well, think about this. Like, this was, our phones are a miracle. And now we give them to two-year-olds to play with. Like, 20 years ago, and just 20 years ago, an iPhone would have been, or any smartphone, was almost beyond belief. 30, 40 years ago, people couldn't even imagine it. There's more computing power than exists in the iPhone than the NASA in its entirety had trying to bring the Apollo 13 mission back to Earth. Just think of that. That entire headquarters, that control room, you know, you watch the movie and they're working all these different things. Like, they would have killed to have the computing power that an iPhone has. But miracles become mundane if we let them. And I think each of us have miracles in our life that we've looked at so often that we forget how important and special. Each of us, I think, have gifts and abilities that we've known that we look past and we forget how miraculous they are.
Yeah. And that's a sad part about life. And it's in general. It's a sad part of life. So we're coming up close to the end of the show. And these are the 10 questions that I ask all my guests. And I just want to have your perspective on these 10 topics. With the increase in people suffering from depression from the past uncertainty that we've lived through, what's the one thing that you could tell them to keep their hopes up?
Your life matters, and your suffering can produce comfort for somebody else. Your story, your struggles, you can use those to lift up somebody else who's hurting, going through the same things you are.
Cool. What's the one thing that you do daily that amplifies your ability to stay focused?
Talked about the gratitude list. That's definitely part of it. Praying and reading every morning is another part.
If you could pick up the phone right now and call yourself at 20 years old, what would you tell yourself?
Live in the service of others. Find your uniqueness and exploit that in the service of others.
Looking back, would you change anything?
I have regrets, but I love my life right now. And I strive to learn through some of those things that I wish I didn't do, but I can't say that I would change anything because all those things are a part of who I am today.
What's more important to a man, his word or his purpose?
I think they're intimately tied together. And I think when they get divided, that's a loss of integrity. But I think purpose is the magnet that eventually, if we allow it, draws us back into alignment. So I guess I'd have to say purpose.
Cool. What scares you?
Being helpless.
Cool. Where do you see your business, Veritas Wealth Management, in the next 5 years?
We've got folks all over the country right now, but what I would like to do is to see us become more accessible to help more people. We've hired a lot of folks, financial coaches, that deal with the exact same thing, helping people create a better relationship with money, helping people be accountable, helping people connect with other like-minded folks. And we're serving a few thousand families, a couple thousand families right now. I would like to see that expand and grow without anybody on my team losing their own work-life balance. And I would hope that we become not just better at our jobs, but better humans in the process. And I'm excited to add more people to the team. I love every single person in my office. We have, it's become a family, and I want to see that family grow.
Very cool. Very cool. How about you personally? Where do you see yourself personally in the next 5 years?
Honestly, it's doing more stuff like this. It's having more one-to-many conversations. I do believe we have a powerful message. I do believe we have some great tools, some resources, and we do a lot of one-on-one, and that is vital. It's important, but I also want to be doing more of this because I have to scale. I have to be able to, in order to help more families without giving up what's precious in my life, which is my faith, my family, and my own health. I was going to say faith, family, and fitness. That's just too many F's in one sentence. But I have to be able to scale effectively without diluting the power of what we do. So it's more speaking engagements. It's more of this. It's figuring out how to use social media someday, those types of things.
You and me both. With the social media. Where can people find more about you?
So our website is veritasalaska.com. We also have another link, oilfieldretirement.com. And you get information beyond just folks for the oil field, but it's just a specific niche we have. I'm also on LinkedIn. Just look at Chad Hufford Veritas, Chad Hufford Alaska. You can connect with me on there. But those are the best places to find us.
And we will post all the links in the show notes below for everybody to have easy access to you, your website, and your services.
Perfect.
Any final thoughts?
Well, first of all, this has been uplifting to me. I've really enjoyed this, John. It's been a pleasure and an honor talking to you, talking to your audience. I hope people have valuable takeaways. And I would just ask people to wake up every morning and choose excellence. It's not a one-time decision. It's a decision we have to make every day. And another Ed Milet quote, we don't always get our goals, but we always eventually get our standards. So even when we're going through difficult times, we're going through setbacks, we cannot afford to lower our standards. Choose excellence every morning and then wake up tomorrow and choose it again.
Chad, thank you so much for coming on the show. This was like next level. I love the conversation that we had, and I could go another 2 hours with you talking about how to improve people's financial state of being, because I know personally how if a man can't feel that he's fulfilling his duty for his family financially, he feels less of a man. That is clear cut. And that was a big beacon for me earlier this year. So for you to be helping people, families get over that hump, I mean, that's beautiful. It's beautiful. I mean, there's nothing better than that. I mean, it builds a boom for a man's self-confidence as well. So thank you so much for your services, and thank you so much for all that you do. And this conversation was next level.
It's been my pleasure and honor. Thank you, John.
Going through hard times is just a test. What you need to know is that when you get out of whatever you're going through, you will be stronger than ever before, and you don't need to go through it alone. Always know that you are not alone. Stay tuned for more real people with amazing stories that are just like yours. Until then, to everyone out there listening, I wish you a good morning, good afternoon, or good night wherever you may be in this crazy world. Hey guys, John from Resilient Reboot Productions and the Fitness Oracle. I just wanted to thank you for watching this episode, and I really do hope that you enjoyed it. Please don't forget to subscribe, hit that bell, and share this episode if you are watching this on YouTube or on Rumble. If you are listening to this on iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Breaker FM, or whatever streaming service that you may be using, please give us a 5-star rating and a positive review, as it will help us reach out to more people that are suffering from mental health issues. Now, if you haven't done so already, I am offering access to a free weekly newsletter that we send out every Sunday, and it's jam-packed with podcasting tips and health and wellness tips to keep you balanced in the podcasting and content creating space. So if you haven't done so already, sign up to this free newsletter. It's totally free, and it also gives you access to the Fitness Oracle private community in Mighty Networks, where we talk about this episode. We talk about how to implement, how you have implemented these lessons that you've picked up in your life and how it's impacted your life. And we are working on a lot of great other programs and support systems for you guys to be able to access. So if you haven't done so already, sign up to the newsletter, and I'll see you guys on the inside.